Okay, well, good evening, everybody, and thank you all for coming today. It's really a great pleasure to have Bernard here, but before I introduce Bernard, I just want to point out to you that he is, in fact, chairman of the Scientific and Medical Network. Now, many of you will know about the Scientific and Medical Network. If you would like to join it, or if you want more information on the Study Society, particularly on the events of both organizations, then leave your name and email on forms on the landing. So there are forms on the landing out there or on the visitor's book in the hall. So those are the notices. And now it's a really great pleasure to welcome Bernard, who, as I've said, is chairman of the Scientific and Medical Network. He is an international figure. We are extremely lucky having him here today. Astrophysicist, I asked him, can I introduce him as that? Cosmologist, he said. So choose your pick. When I say he's internationally well known, he's attended Trinity where he was an undergraduate, postgraduate, and took his PhD there. He then became a fellow at Trinity, and he was then finally poached by a London college, Queen Mary's, where he's been ever since. One of his interests has been the multiverse. Is there just one universe or other multiverses? And he's had a number of conferences on that. He also was involved in a conference in Trinity on the near-death experience as well. But not only is he extremely well-known academically, but also he has an interest in parapsychology and was president of the Parapsychological Foundation. So he is extremely wide in his understanding of nature and also in his technical understanding of the world and what it is. He goes to Japan. All the best people go to Japan. And he, in fact, has a room in an organization in Tokyo. And as you know, he's married a most lovely Japanese wife who sadly can't be with him here this evening. So then let me invite Bernard to give us his talk, which is called Making Space and Time for Mind.
Thank you, Peter. It's a delight to be here. I've often been in this room attending lectures, but it's the first time I've spoken myself to the Study Society. I suppose space and time are my professional business. That's to say, my respectable academic work is in the areas of space and time because I study relativity theory. But my other great passion is mind. And this gives me a chance to bring them together in this talk, because, of course, I have to be a bit careful what I say about mind to my professional colleagues. But I know to this audience I can be completely uninhibited. So I'm going to talk about my approach really as a physicist to the problem of linking matter and mind. There's always the danger that it will get too technical, because I know you're not physicists. So if I'm saying something you don't understand, well, it may mean I didn't understand it myself, but just ask me a question or slow me down, and I'll do my best to try and get across these ideas. My opening picture, you'll see there is a little bridge, and the bridge is a very powerful symbol for me. And it has, well, first of all, before I get onto the bridge, if you want to read more about the things I'm going to say tonight, there are various articles I've written. I don't have them with me. I wrote a huge 100-page proceedings for the Society for Psychical Research, which has got a lot of gory detail. I got two more, much more digestible, shorter versions in the Scientific Network Review. And imminently, there will be a version coming out in the Contact, your magazine, Seeking a Grand Unification of Matter, Mind and Spirit. So that's the one I'd most recommend. Now, going back to the bridge. Now, to me, a bridge is what we're trying to build. And what is the bridge connecting? Well, it can be read in various ways. First of all, it's some sort of bridge between matter and mind. As a physicist, I spend most of my time thinking about matter, but as someone who's interested in the matters of this group is all interested in, I'm interested in mind and trying to make some sort of connection between them. I want to have a theory of physics, essentially, which is going to accommodate mind and even spirituality. Of course, it's also a bridge between experiments and experience. You know, in French, it's the same word. Expérience means experiment and experience, but we make a separation of the concepts. And of course, experiment is what you do as a scientist, whereas experience is what we have. And it's again trying to make that link. It's the link between the third person account of the world, which scientists have to use, and the first person account. Scientists are always interested in what's out there and our consensus view of how things behave in the outside world. And the question is, how do you link that to my experience, my first-person experience? And then, of course, that itself is part of the trying to build that bridge between science and spirituality. And, of course, that's very much what the Scientific and Medical Network is about. Peter mentioned I'm the chairman of the SMN, but I would say that if there's, of course, it does many things, but in some sense, building the link between science and spirituality is one of the key remits of the SMN. And of course, some of you may have been to the Mystics and Scientists meeting, which we have every year, and that's explicitly about that. So that's really what is the background of my aim. Now, I want to start off talking as a physicist, and I want to show you my favorite image, which is the cosmic Ouroboros. Hands up if you've seen this, so I don't have to. Do you all know about the cosmic Ouroboros? What it is, it's the snake which swallows its own tail, but that's, of course, a symbol, a mythic symbol in many contexts, but I'm using it in a very particular way because I'm using it to represent the various scales of structure that exist in the universe. So down at the bottom, we've got human beings. And then as you go to the right, you'll get to larger and larger scales. So you have mountains, the planet, the sun, the galaxy, the solar system, the galaxy, and the universe. And then on the left, you've got increasingly smaller things. So you've got an ant, rather hard to see the ant in the dark, they like it that way, the ant and the amoeba and the DNA and the atom and the nucleus, and all the way up to the top, which is the smallest scale you can think of. So you can think of this Ouroboros, it's a sort of ruler, okay, of in which as you go clockwise, or as you go anti-clockwise, the scale increases by a power of 10 for every minute. So that's the symbol of it. And what's so important about this is that on the right, therefore, we've got the macroscopic domain, and on the left, we've got the microscopic domain. And why does the snake swallow its own tail? Well, that's because the universe began with a big bang. So that's a very profound idea. And the reason for that is as follows. We think the universe began with a big bang. So when you go back in time, it gets smaller and smaller. But when you look out to the greatest distances, you're also looking back in time. And so when you look too far back in time, the universe is becoming very, very small. And that is why the very large merges with the very small. Okay, because when you look back basically to something like 14,000 million light years, the universe has become a point. But anyway, that's the Ouroboros, and it's going to feature a bit in the first 5 minutes or so of my talk. So the history of science, you can think of as the expansion of our consciousness to ever larger and smaller scales. And so, for example, let's start on the terrestrial scale. As we've looked to larger scales, using telescopes and more powerful ways of observing the universe, we've got to understand the universe on bigger and bigger scales. And so our perspective of the universe has changed. And you'll all know about the history of science. We started off with this geocentric perspective, which says that the Earth was the center of the universe, with the sun going around the Earth. But then, as you know, Copernicus came along and replaced it with a heliocentric view, which says that the sun is the center of the universe, and the Earth goes around the sun. And then later on, we realized that actually the sun itself is not special. It's just one of 100,000 million galaxies, stars, which make up the galaxy. And so at that point, and now we're something like the beginning of the 20th century, the world is, our universe is the galaxy, and that's all there is. So that was the galactocentric view. But then round about 1920s, we discovered that actually the galaxy is just one of 100 billion other galaxies. And so then we took the cosmocentric view, which says that the universe, the cosmos, we are just one of billions of galaxies in the cosmos, but the cosmos is the universe, is all there is. But then, in just the last 10 or 20 years or so, we've discovered there might be other universes as well. Our universe could just be like one bubble among many, many other bubbles. And so that's the concept of the multiverse. I think Peter mentioned the multiverse. I'm interested in the multiverse because I wrote a book on it. But the point I'm trying to make is that as we look out to ever larger scales, our view of the universe is continually shifting. We're going through these paradigm shifts. Well, what about on the smaller scale? Well, the inward journey has also been interesting and has produced these paradigm shifts. We start off with our microscopes and discovering, for example, we realize that everything is made of atoms. So the atomic view, which originally goes all the way back to the Greeks, but it was really only in the 18th century, really, with Mendel and people, that it became clear that atoms exist. And only in the 20th century did we start actually detecting them. And also we discovered that there was forces of nature. We discovered the electric force, and the electric force holds the electron to the atom, to the proton, but also holds solid objects together. So we started discovering there were these connections between the microscopic and the macroscopic domains. And then we discovered there were nuclei, looking with our particle physics experiments. And then we discovered with the nuclei that there were also different forces. There was the weak and the strong force in nature. That's the nuclear forces hold the atom, the nuclei together in a nucleus. But also, they are what power the sun. The sun produces energy through nuclear reactions, which are regulated by weak interactions, which are associated with radioactive decay. So there's another link there. Of course, there's an example of the nuclear force, the atom bomb, unfortunately. And then, of course, now we know that the forces can be unified. We have the electroweak force. The electric and the weak forces are actually part of a single force. It was discovered in the 1970s. That was the standard model. And then that's the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, which of course has verified some of the features of that standard model. We've also discovered there are other particles, elementary particles called enos, which make up the dark matter. And so those elementary particles which we hope to discover maybe at CERN are also producing maybe the dark matter, which we know exists around galaxies. And then finally, on the smallest scale of all, because we know that This isn't the final theory. The final theory we now think of as maybe as M theory, which is on the smallest conceivable scale. We're talking about things on what's called the Planck scale, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. Now, and so that's the artist's impression of that small scale. And so this, therefore, summarizes, if you like, the triumph of physics in understanding the universe on every scale. And as I say, it comes from a fact that we've studied, we've looked at ever larger scales and ever smaller scales, and we've discovered basically all the things that exist in the physical universe. We've discovered the forces which hold things together, and we've got this wonderful symmetry between the micro and the macro world. And to me, this diagram is beautiful because it actually encapsulates all our knowledge of the physical world. But also, there's something else we have to understand about, which connects to my title. And besides the objects in the world, there is space and time themselves. So we have to understand a little bit about that. You see, in the Newtonian picture, Newton, remember, discovered gravity, really the start of proper science. And the world is three-dimensional. Space is three-dimensional, in the sense that there are three directions you can go, up and down, left and right, forwards and backwards. And so this three-dimensional space is the arena for all of physics as we knew it, classical physics, the Newtonian view of the world. And of course, also there was time, and for Newton, time was absolute. It flowed at the same rate for everybody. That clock's a bit wrong. Sorry, that's an hour wrong. It must be on summertime. Sorry about that. Yeah. Anyway, so that was a Newtonian view. And that prevailed for 300 years, or until Einstein. And then Einstein came along, and he had a different view. Now, this is where it may get a bit technical, but I think you'd be familiar with this idea, but I just want to get the words across anyway. The idea is that you merge space and time into a four-dimensional space-time. And so whereas the Newtonian view... Is there a pointer, Martin? Not to worry. Whereas the Newtonian view is that really you just have slices of space, three-dimensional space at different times, so as time goes forward, you go from one slice to the other. Three-dimensional space plus time. Einstein's view is that you have to merge space and time into four dimensions. And for various reasons, that is explained all sorts of problems in physics. And the theory of special relativity, which was born in 1905, that is now the basic to all our understanding of the universe. So there is a fourth dimension. This is a more simple picture for those of you who don't want anything with axes. This is just basically a network of rulers and clocks. And so that is our view of reality now. It's four-dimensional space-time. And the fourth dimension is time. Now, you might think that was a bit complicated, but that's only the beginning of the story. Because it turns out that the world that physics has revealed is more complicated than that. And this is also going to be quite an important part of my talk. It turns out that there are actually extra dimensions. Now, these are very hard to envisage, so don't try to visualize them. But nevertheless, this is the picture, the standard picture of physics, which most physicists now accept. And the idea actually goes back to Kaluza and Klein. Theodore Kaluza and Oscar Klein in the 1920s. Einstein had succeeded in explaining gravity, the force of gravity, by assuming that you had space and time and you curve space and time. So it was a sort of geometrical interpretation of gravity. And Kaluza and Klein said, well, I can also explain electromagnetism, the other force it was then known about, by saying there's a fifth dimension. So the fifth dimension is sort of perpendicular to the... It's another spatial dimension, except you can't see it. Now, why can't you see it? Well, the reason you can't see it is because it's compactified. It's it's wrapped up very, very, very small. And that's why it's much smaller than the wavelength of light, which is how your eyes see. So you, it's there, you just don't see it. And the way to look at this, if you look up it close up, it's compactified in the sense that it would be nice to have a pointer, Martin, but... hi, Tatsu. Anyway, I will just use my pen. No, that won't help. But anyway, the idea is that...
Can you use the one on here?
No, I don't... Oh, well, that's quite clever. Thank you. I've never done that. Thank you.
There you are.
Yes, thank you. So you see how useful your a stick would have helped as well, but I mean, I'll use the modern technology. So the point is that... No, I want your stick. Sorry. Thank you. Because if I can reach far enough, the little arrow keeps disappearing. Actually, it's not big enough anyway. But anyway, I'll go back to the little arrow. Thank you very much, though. So the point is this: that it's a little bit like a hose pipe. If you look at a hose pipe close up, you know that actually it's got a cross section. But of course, it's much longer than it is across, and so if you go a long way away, you don't see the thickness of the hose pipe. It's just like a line. And so the idea is that the three spatial dimensions are like the length of the hose pipe, and there's this extra spatial dimension, not time, which is the fourth dimension. It's this fifth dimension, and so there is a fifth dimension, but we just don't know it. We can't see it. But nevertheless, this is supposed to explain the laws of electromagnetism. Well, for 50 years, no one paid much attention to that. But then, in 1984, people realized that they could actually explain all the other forces in nature by invoking other wrapped-up dimensions. Now, in superstring theory, there were six of these extra dimensions. And in M theory, which I mentioned, there are actually 11 of them. And that's the most popular one at the moment. So the idea is that you start off with four dimensions, and then we go to five dimensions, then we go to 10 dimensions, and then we go to 11 dimensions. So just as we looked to larger and larger scales, we found the universe was bigger and bigger. When we look at the smaller and smaller scales, at these interactions, we find there are more and more dimensions. So it's a bit bizarre, but that's the picture of the world we have. And in fact, there's a modern version of this in which you say, well, actually, one of these extra dimensions, instead of being wrapped up very small, is actually extended. And so the picture we have of the world then is that our four-dimensional world, is sort of this brain, B-R-A-N-E, not to be confused with the brain in my head, and then it's in this higher dimensional bulk, this five-dimensional bulk, as it's called. But so that's just one particular model of higher dimensions. So the idea is you've got these, you're increasing dimensionality, but you've got this particular picture in which the material world, what we call the physical world, is like a slice of this higher dimensional space. Now, that's as far as I'm going to go. I hope, is that okay? You're not feeling too saturated, because that's the most difficult thing tonight, that concept that there are higher dimensions. Now, higher dimensions are hard to understand. I mean, when I talk about higher dimensions, people come up and say, that was absolutely fascinating, I didn't understand a word of it. Well, it is hard to understand higher dimensions, but it's crucial to my message tonight. And so the message is that science has given us a sort of sequence of paradigm shifts in which the dimensionality of the world goes up. And as it does so, I mean, because the main thing you're going to say, well, I don't believe in these extra dimensions. They don't relate to anything I experience. Fair enough. So that's the point, that the reality which is revealed by modern physics seems to be increasingly remote from our common sense reality. But that's something you've got to face. And that is the price you pay for this wonderful unification. You remember I started off with this picture of all the structures, the Ouroboros, and all the forces of nature which link everything together. That wonderful unified view of the world, the price you pay for that is that your view of reality is a bit uncomfortable. It's not the one you're used to. But now let's go back to this Ouroboros again. So let's just summarize this. There's the Ouroboros. This is meant to be the meeting of the universe at the Big Bang, of the macro and the micro world. And I put a little crown there to indicate physics is king. Okay? We've sold everything. Fantastic. And so the crown of physics, and then at the right at the peak, the multiverse and M theory, which in some sense, if you like, is the climax of what the physicists have discovered. The multiverse is the extreme large-scale, M theory, the extreme small-scale, and they meet there. And so this is what's said to be our final, what the physicists sometimes say, they're close to this final theory, this theory of everything. However, and there are the higher dimensions, because these extra dimensions I'm talking about only really come in when the universe is close to a small scale. So the universe today looks obviously three-dimensional space, but when you get back to the Big Bang, it becomes higher-dimensional. So the higher dimensions come in at the point where the snake swallows its tail. But now there's something missing in this picture. And does anyone who hasn't heard my talk before know what that is? Another thing beginning with M. Yes, was it you? Mind. There's something missing, and it's the missing jewel. It's the mind. Okay. And so that's rather worrying, you know, because actually, that's a big component of the universe. I mean, physics is basically has nothing to say about mind, and yet it's meant to be a theory of everything. Yet it's missing out most of our experience. All of our experience. And the other thing about this diagram of all the scales of structure, right there at the bottom, you remember, were the human beings, the brain. So you can think of the universe, the history of the Big Bang is a history of evolving complexity. You build galaxies and stars and planets and then life and eventually people and eventually brains. B-R-A-I-N. So we're all on a brain, B-R-A-N-E, but the culmination of complexity is the brain, B-R-A-I-N. But this brings about a bit of a paradox. Because if you look at your brain, the key features of the brain are, of course, that consciousness, minds, and indeed spirituality. Those are what we experience. And yet, what does science say about that? Mainstream science, not the enlightened sciences such as sitting in the front row, but mainstream science. Consciousness is just an excretion of neurons. It's basically a purely passive thing, okay? It's irrelevant. The mind is a purely passive role. We observe the universe, we think about it, but we don't do anything. And blatantly not true, and you can just see what human minds have done to the planet. But nevertheless, that's the naive view, that minds do not affect the physical world. And then, of course, religion, spirituality, and mystical insights, which are so interest to the SMN and to the study society, of course, that's all illusion. And so the culmination of the complexity of this triumphant picture, you neglect. Which is obviously not very satisfactory. So let's look a bit at how physicists respond, think about, not just physicists, but people more generally, think about consciousness. Now, the first view is the view which I've sort of represented, that consciousness is completely unimportant. And let me give you a few quotes. This is John Watson. He was the person who discovered behaviorism, the founder of behaviorism in psychology. The time seems to have come when psychology must discard all reference to consciousness, when it need no longer delude itself into thinking that it is making mental states, the objects of observation. So here's psychologists saying, let's forget mind. Here's Daniel Dennett, a philosopher. Consciousness appears to be the last bastion of occult properties, epiphenomena and immeasurable subjective states. In short, the one area of mind best left to philosophers, who are welcome to it. Let them make fools of themselves trying to corral the quicksilver of phenomenology into a respectable theory. Okay. And here's another view from Brian Pippard, who was a physicist at Cambridge who I knew. He had a more balanced view. He was talking about psychic phenomena, but really his remark is of more general relevance. If the existence of psi phenomena is doubtful, it is not because they cannot be invoked in physical terms. They involve, after all, a class of system beyond the scope of physical theory. That is to say, conscious human beings. I do not say consciousness is not at this time understood from the laws of physics. I say it cannot be so understood. So what he's saying is he's not denying consciousness, not even denying its importance. He's just saying it's not in the domain of physics. And that's a view which many physicists take. They simply say consciousness has nothing to do with physics. But now let's look at some other view. Well, this, of course, gives us a rather depressing view of the world. I mean, you've seen this wonderful picture of everything. We've explained everything in the universe. But this is a Peanuts cartoon. You are of no importance, did you know that? You are only the tiniest speck in the enormous universe. Then I might as well go to sleep. And you, I hope, have not gone to sleep. But the famous quote from Steven Weinberg, the more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it seems pointless. And in some sense, that's what that Ouroboros is conveying, how comprehensible the universe has become. But at the same time, most of the people who've given us that picture are finding it pointless. But here's another set of views who'd say consciousness is important. Eugene Wigner. It is not possible to formulate the laws of physics in a fully consistent way without reference to the consciousness of the observer. Now, most of these physicists were interested in quantum theory. We'll see how that comes in. John Wheeler, mind and universe are complementary. These are all physicists. Bernard Despagnier, the doctrine that the world is made up of objects whose existence is independent of human consciousness turns out to be in conflict with quantum mechanics and with facts established by experiments. The key thing about quantum mechanics is it suggests that the mind, consciousness, may play a role in the physical world. The observation of the physical world changes it. Noam Chomsky, the linguist. Physics must expand to explain mental experiences. And he's not a physicist, but we must still listen to him. He's a bright guy. And Roger Penrose, we need a revolution in physics on the scale of quantum theory and relativity before we can understand mind. So, we've got these two views. Now, I think it should be clear which view I'm going from. The second one. But why do we think that, what are the clues from physics itself that mind is fundamental? I mean, I think we all appreciate that mind is fundamental anyway, but why do we think as physicists that it's fundamental? Part of one of the arguments is to do with the anthropic principle. This is one of my favorite topics I won't talk about now, but the sort of fine tunings in the universe and the values of the physical constants, which seem to be required for us to be here. So something in the physical world seems to be determined by our existence, by the existence of consciousness. If we didn't have these tunings, we wouldn't be here thinking about the universe. The other one is to do with quantum theory. Now, John Wheeler, for example, has a lovely image. In quantum theory, the universe is described by a wave function, which describes all possible states. And the idea is that until someone observes that wave function, it hasn't collapsed into an actual realized state. So it's rather like tossing a coin. It's a superposition of heads and tails until I look. But until then, it's a combination of heads and tails. And the universe is like that. It's described by a wave function. And the idea is that once consciousness arises, it collapses the wave function and the universe takes on a particular form. And this is Wheeler's image here. Here's the Big Bang evolves to produce brains and eyes which contemplate, they link, contemplate the Big Bang and they make a sort of closed circuit, a self-excited universe. So this is why Wheeler thought consciousness played an important role in the universe through quantum theory. And this is a nice image of the hand creating itself. Part of quantum theory is that the observing the universe actually creates the universe. So you've got this lovely image of the hands drawing themselves. But the third argument is to do with parapsychology. Now, I'm interested in parapsychology. Peter mentioned I was the president of the Society for Psychical Research, not Parapsychology Foundation. But and I'm sure you all know what I mean by psychic phenomena, so I don't need to describe that. Suffice it to say that most physicists aren't particularly interested in psychical phenomena. They don't believe them. They exist. Not because they've looked at the evidence, but because they have a prejudice against it. But anyway, I personally do take these phenomena seriously, and they're part of what I'm trying to explain. But the problem of mind goes much deeper than the problem of parapsychology. I mean, even if you don't believe in any of these psychic phenomena, there is still the problem of how you explain ordinary mind. Okay, ordinary consciousness. Never mind paranormal. Even the challenge of how to explain normal phenomena is what we have to confront. Because at the moment, physics can't do that. And now, I expect you're aware that the favorite contender for a physical explanation of psychic phenomena is quantum theory. And I don't want to go into this in much detail, but here's Evan Harris-Walker, who said, this must lie at the heart of the solution to the problem of psi phenomena. And indeed, any understanding of psi phenomena and of consciousness must provide the basis of an improved understanding of quantum mechanics. So he says you need quantum mechanics to explain psi, and you need psi to understand quantum mechanics. Remember, we don't understand quantum mechanics very well. We know it works, but we don't have a deep understanding of it. And quantum mechanics is complicated, and there are many aspects of it which people have thought about in this context, but one of them is the idea of entanglement. And the idea of entanglement is that, for example, let's imagine something decays and particles go off in two opposite directions. And the idea is that by measuring the state of the object over there, it might be two particles with opposite spins, and the idea is that by measuring the state of the particle over there, you are actually determining the state of the particle over there. And for various reasons, this violates causality, because you can show that when I measure the state of this particle, it changes the state of that particle faster than can be explained by normal causal mechanisms. So this is the concept of non-locality in quantum mechanics. It violates our normal classical view of the world. There's a link outside space and time, and this is it's called non-locality. Now, entanglement, there's no doubt that it's true. It's tested experimentally. And it can be tested on all sorts of scales. I mean, it can be tested on the scale. Originally, it was discovered for elementary particles, but now we know it works for atoms bigger and bigger atoms. We know it's been even for proteins. So we know that this phenomena of entanglement occurs on macroscopic scales. In fact, now it's been tested on scales of meters, even hundreds of meters. So entanglement occurs, and it goes against all the classical laws of physics associated with Newton. Well, what's that got to do with psi? Well, one of the great champions of this idea is Dean Radin. And the concept is, well, what happens if this entanglement, which originally was thought of as just as a physical linkage between elementary particles, what happens if this entanglement applies on all scales? What happens if it applies within individual brains or between different brains in this room, or indeed across the whole planet? Can you have a larger scale of, or across the whole universe? And so Radin says, what if the universe were fully entangled? What would experience be like in that holistic medium? And so the idea is, you see, that with the classical medium, you've got two people, and they can only communicate through time, through sound and light waves, in the normal classical methods, using the brain. But the idea is there might be another way of communicating, this holistic way, related to this idea of entanglement. Communicating in a way that transcends space and time. And the idea is that this is allowed through quantum theory, that there's another level of communication which can go on. And this is a very popular idea. There are many other quantum approaches to the problem. There's a lot of interest in the vacuum energy density. I'm sure you've heard about this, especially because we now know the universe is dominated. You know, 70% of the universe's energy is actually in its vacuum, in the dark energy. So we know, actually, we're dominated by vacuum energy. That's what actually drives the universe, is accelerating, not only expanding, it's accelerating, driven by this vacuum energy. Now, vacuum energy is a thing that comes out of physics, but lots of people have endowed that with, if you like, mystical implications. So, for example, Laszlo thinks of vacuum energy as this pervasive energy field which connects living systems. Puthoff, he talks about zero-point fluctuation. Puthoff is a well-known physicist, okay? And he says, all of us are immersed, both as living and physical beings, in an overall interpenetrating and interdependent field in ecological balance with the cosmos as a whole. The unitary viewpoint of the universe as a fluid, changing, energetic information, cosmological unity. Sorry, that's a bit of a mouthful. But I'm sure you get the basic idea that the idea is the vacuum is not completely empty. It's always a froth of energy. The idea that this is linking us all. Antilla is interested in the so-called subtle energy field, which he associates with healing and things like that. And he thinks that these subtle energy fields are connected with this vacuum as well. I'm sure you're all used to all this talk about subtle energy fields. So in holistic medicine, I think. So the idea is that it might have some link to vacuum energy. I have to say, these subtle energy fields are so subtle that you can't detect them, which is part of the problem. But anyway, maybe that's getting a little bit too technical. But my own view is this. My own view is that actually quantum theory alone will not explain the problem of mind. But what's interesting about quantum theory is that it does suggest that mind plays a role in the universe, but it isn't an explicit model of mind. Because after all, no one understands quantum theory anyway. So saying that quantum theory explains mind is really not explaining anything. It's just replacing one mystery by another. So what we really need is a deeper paradigm which is going to explain both quantum theory and mind. So that's the aim. So let's go back to our cosmic Ouroboros. The question is there room for mind? Now, you see, we went through all those... Remember, we went through all those geocentric, heliocentric, galactocentric, cosmocentric views, and one by one the universe got bigger, and we forgot the earlier restricted view. So what I'm really saying is, well, what about the escape from the matter-centric view? Can we get away from the view that all that exists is matter? And so you see, we've got quantum theory on the left and relativity theory on the right. These are our two great theories of physics, the two pillars of modern physics. Quantum theory, which is the domain of the micro domain, and relativity theory, which is the macro domain. And I've told you a little bit about those. You know, relativity was the space-time, four-dimensional space-time, and quantum theory is wave functions and things. But the strange thing is that those theories are incompatible. Our two fundamental theories don't fit together. And so the great challenge of physics is to have a final way of reconciling quantum theory and relativity theory. Now, most of the attention from the people interested in physics or paraphysics comes from quantum theory, which is this direction here. They're trying to explain mind. Remember, I'm putting mind at the top there, but I'm actually interested, I'm a relativist, and I'm interested in the insights that come from relativity theory. And I'm going to give you a theory, a paradigm of mind, which really comes from relativity theory. Okay? But I'm going to argue that these are actually linked. Because remember, mind is there up at the top in this picture. Well, I should say that's in my paradigm, mind is there at the top. And the question is, will the marriage of quantum and relativity theory, which is the great aim of physics, will that accommodate mind? And that's the message I want to get across. That the final theory of physics will, by necessity, incorporate mind. Now, of course, this is not a popular idea in physics. I would get a lot of trouble if I say that, but most physicists will disagree, but that's the view I want to get across. And the key thing is going to be, you remember, up there at the top, this is the domain of higher dimensions. And so I'm going to argue that these higher dimensions are going to be the clue to this new paradigm of extended physics, if you like. And the way I think about this is we've really got space, time, matter, and mind. I mean, space, of course, is linked to matter because matter exists in space. Now, time ultimately is related to mind. If you ask where does time come from, it really comes from our experience of the world. And, of course, we know space and time were unified by Einstein in space-time. Matter and mind, well, they're linked through observation. And, of course, relativity is the domain of space-time, and quantum theory is the domain of observation. So this final unification of matter, mind, space, and time is what I'm interested in. So what I'm saying is that the merging of relativity and quantum theory is also going to be a merging of space-time with matter and mind. And so, really, I want to spend the rest of the talk giving you some idea how this works. So, but in doing this, I'm going to have to revise what we mean by these terms. In other words, we're going to have to expand the concept of space and the concept of time and indeed the concept of matter and mind. So this is just a nice famous picture. I explained that science explores ever wider domains of space, thereby providing ever growing map of material reality. That was the Ouroboros, okay? But the question is, and so there's the guy with his little head pointing out the latest horizon, you know? And of course he gets through that horizon and then he finds there's another one beyond that. But the question is, are there other types of space and are there other levels of non-material reality? Okay, so the picture is we need a new paradigm. This is a new paradigm which must incorporate consciousness. In some sense, it's going to transcend space and time because one of the features of our anomalous experiences and altered states, and mystical experiences, is a transcendence of space and time. I would say not an actual complete destruction of space and time, but a different view of space and time, expanded view of space and time. But also, it's got to be a paradigm which actually incorporates mental phenomena in some radically new way. And so I want to tell you what that picture is. Now, Martin, tell me how long I can talk for, because you said 2 hours, but I know you don't want to talk for 2 hours. So how long do you want me to talk for?
Another half hour and then half an hour.
Is that all right? Half an hour? Is that okay? So, now, I've been talking about physics so far, so I hope it wasn't too tough. I mean, it's pretty straightforward, really. It's 11 dimensions, quantum wave functions. But anyway, obviously you can ask me more at the end, and of course there are lots of popular books on the subject. But I want to now go into actually the domain of philosophy for a while. Because what I'm, of course, I'm going to say we need an extension of physics which provides an explicit model of mind. And what do I mean by a model of mind? Because mind comes in different forms, and I'd like to distinguish between normal mind, paranormal mind, and spiritual mind. And the key thing is that you need a model for all of those. Okay? We're not just trying to explain the paranormal, we're not just trying to explain the spiritual, we're trying to explain the normal. And this word physics, one has to be a little bit careful about what you mean by physics. I will get into trouble even calling this physics, because it's not physics as we know it. What is it that Kuo says? It's life, Jim, but not as we know it. Well, this is physics, Peter, but not as we know it. So I call it hyperphysics, partly to avoid getting into trouble with my non-hyperphysical colleagues. And let me just start off. I've got this. I like this diagram, which actually plots our different sorts of mental experiences. And on the y-axis, I've got frequency. On the x-axis, I've got their impact. And it's interesting to write down these various experiences. So you go from common to rare on the y-axis, and I go from mundane to profound on the x-axis. And you know what I mean by all these things. We've got gut feelings, deja vu. These are common, mundane experiences. Then we get rather rarer experiences, but more impact, telepathy, clairvoyance, distant healing, premonitions. And then we get to somewhat more profound things, which are rarer, creative insight, religious epiphany, oceanic feelings, mystical union. And so you can see, therefore, that there's a spectrum of mental experiences. And everyone experiences those, healers those, psychics those, geniuses those, saints those. This is, in blue, is the domain of normal mind, in red is paranormal mind, and in purple is spiritual. And so I want a theory which is going to explain everything. I know it sounds a bit ambitious, but I mean, I don't just want a theory of psi, and I don't just want a theory of ordinary perception. I want a theory which explains everything. And here are just, I always put this up, this is St. Francis Assisi, St. Teresa of Attila, Raman, know him, who he is? The mathematician, Ramanujan, Einstein, we've already figured him. Do you know who that is? See if you can predict the answer. Nostradamus. Here is Marie Curie. There's a wonderful film about Marie Curie. Did you see it on television last week? It was really interesting. Finally, I wanted somebody to represent normal mind. These are all very special people. Now, the only normal person I know is me. Yeah. But that was when I had a beard, and I got rid of my beard, and I'm not normal anymore. So, anyway, so the key message I want to get across about all these phenomena is that we need space and time for mind. The main message I want to get across, indeed, it's the title of my talk, I think, is that to describe these mental experiences, they nearly all require some form of space and some form of time, but not normal space and not normal time. So that's the message I want to get across. And I want to start off with a little this philosophical issue. First of all, let's say we want to understand ordinary sensory perception before we can understand extrasensory perception. So I want to start off just talking about ordinary sensation, our perception of the physical world. Because what I want to suggest is that even understanding ordinary perception raises all sorts of philosophical problems, which philosophers have argued about for hundreds of years, and that you have to understand those problems before you can go on to understand the bigger problem. And so the question is, what is the relationship between mind and the world? Now, let's take a normal physical percept. The normal view we have, I don't know if it's going to work, this little arrow, is here is the brain, here is the cat in the physical world, and you know the normal idea is that the light rays from the cat go into the brain and stimulate things in the brain and the visual cortex, and the brain sort of produces some image in perceptual space. So you have physical space and you've got perceptual space. So this arrow doesn't always appear, but there we go. So that's our view of physical perception, and that's what we call representative theory. And in representative theory, perceptual space is secondary. There's physical space out there, and it sort of generates perceptual space as an internal construct. Now, the other view is naive realism. And naive realism says, well, the percept is the object. The cat I see is the cat. Perceptual space is physical space. And so philosophically, for hundreds of years, there was this battle between representative theory and naive realism. Well, of course, nowadays, no one really believes in naive realism because we know the physical processes that go on in the brain, and we know that you can do all sorts of things in the brain which affect how the world changes. So on the face of it, representation theory seems a one. However, you have to be a little bit careful here because physics says that even the object itself is a representation. You remember these pictures I was telling you about, these high-dimensional models of physics? Well, what it's saying is that actually the objects, the three-dimensional objects, are not the ultimate reality. They themselves are just like a representation of a higher-dimensional thing. So even what we're calling the physical object is a representation. And so this distinction between representative theory and naive realism isn't so straightforward. And then the other problem is, well, what about mental percepts? What about the cat which I close my eyes and I see the cat in my mind, okay? Well, there's no physical cat, that's in my mind. So how, you might think in that context, the cat, naive realism was right in some sense. So there's something fishy about this. And that's the fundamental philosophical problem we've got to get to grips with before we can even think about this higher picture. Now, of course, the normal physical picture of three-dimensional reality is that you've got your, let's say we've got two observers. They're all looking at the cat. They both produce their little perceptual cats. But the idea is that we exist in a three-dimensional world, okay? And in this three-dimensional world, it's a three-dimensional space. You locate the brains and you locate the cats, and you are able to predict how the cat should appear, because if I know where I'm standing in the direction I'm looking, I know how the world should appear. It's like a projection of a three-dimensional world. And when we say there's a three-dimensional reality, I mean I can reconcile the different ways in which we all see the world by saying we are in a three-dimensional reality. Okay, that's what we mean. Yes, I would. Sorry, there's a lot of words there, and I don't like it when people talk over words. So I will read it again without talking. No, I can't do that. I don't like it when people say something different from what is on the screen. So let me read it again. There exists a three-dimensional space in which are localized both physical objects and the senses through which we observe the objects. Each observer has only partial information about this space, but there exists a three-dimensional configuration which gives two-dimensional projections concordant with those presented. Reality is a three-dimensional structure which consistently reconciles our perceptions of it. So that's common sense, and that's what you would imagine. But it's wrong. We know it's wrong because we actually know, and that I should say, is what gives rise ultimately to this conflict between naive realism and representative theory. But we know it's wrong because we know the world is actually four-dimensional. Relativity theory implies that the physical world is four-dimensional, with objects and observers being represented by world lines and perceptual fields being three-dimensional paths, light cones. Reality is a four-dimensional structure which consistently reconciles our perceptions of it. So let me draw a picture. Now, this is why, again, this may get a bit complicated, but in this diagram, space and time, the light cone, light goes along, light travels at the speed of light, so it's on a light cone. So what happens is, your brain is the world line. In four dimensions, you just go up in the time direction, so you're a world line. The cat has a world line. Where the world line of the cat intersects my past light cone is where I see the cat. So my experience of the world, therefore, can be described in terms of world lines and the light rays which intersect them. And so the object in the percept, the object is the cat on a slice-like slice. The percept is my intersect of the four-dimensional world tube of the cat with the past light cone. They are different aspects of a single four-dimensional object. So I'll just repeat that. So the idea is that the cat is four-dimensional. This is straight relativity. The intersect of the cat on a space-like surface is what we call the cat. It's the three-dimensional cat. I keep tending to use you instead of a cat, but I don't have you on my slide. So, but then how I see you is actually is not that same. It's another slice. It's the slice on the past light cone. Is that okay? I know it's getting a little bit technical here. So the view we have in terms of these little cartoon diagrams, the idea is, before I had the cat to the physical cat to the right and the perceptual cat to the left. Now I look at it differently. Now I've got the perceptual cat there in the physical world in a box, but that's the physical cat, and the perceptual cat, I draw it as being above in a bigger box, which is the four-dimensional space-time. So the object and the percept are aspects of a four-dimensional structure. Is that okay? Now, now let's contrast the three-dimensional view of reality. The three-dimensional view of the reality says the three-dimensional object produces the two-dimensional percept. The four-dimensional view says no, there is a four-dimensional object, here are two observers, and a single four-dimensional object produces a 3D object and a 3D percept, because the point is our percepts are also effectively three-dimensional, because you get more information than you get from a simple, because we're binocular and things like that. So it's a fundamentally different view of, that's why the relativistic view was so different from the Newtonian view. It's actually, and what isn't always appreciated is that the clash between the naive realism picture and the representative picture sort of goes away, or sort of at least partly goes away in the four-dimensional picture. Now, and so this is this idea. Now, of course, it's very simplistic to say that all our perception is just on the past light cone, because I don't only perceive the world through light rays. I see the world through mirrors and TV cameras and things like that. But the point is, any way you perceive the world can be thought of as some sort of connection in space-time. So, for example, if I look on a telescope, I'm just looking along the past light cone, which is the same thing. I've compressed it to two dimensions to make it a little bit easier. I can look at a photograph. Now, what happens with a photograph? I take a camera, the light goes from the object to the camera, I make a film, the picture stays in space-time, it's like a solid object which goes up forward in time, and then I look at the picture, and then that's a light ray going from the picture to my eye. So that's a different four-dimensional description, but it's still a four-dimensional description. If I look at myself in a mirror, light rays are bouncing off mirrors, but it's still an interaction. Now, the process of perception also involves what goes on in the brain. with the billions of neurons. But even the billions of neurons and the signals correspond to little trajectories in space-time. Now, that's very complicated, so it's best to put a little black box there or a green ball. But the fact is, ultimately, what I'm saying is that perception can always be analysed in terms of these four-dimensional connections. And so, I'll read this. The phenomenal space for any consciousness is the part of space-time connected to the world line of its brain and the sensory extensions through a nexus of signaling world lines. Now, let me just draw you the next picture. So we have this idea of what I call a space-time outlook tree. So here's time and here's space. Here's the world line of my brain, and so there's that's my present consciousness at the top there. This is my past light cone. But basically, my experience of the world is all those parts of space-time to which I'm connected through this nexus of signaling. The concept of an extended mind. I mean, this is a word which Rupert Sheldrake uses a lot, an extended mind. And it's really crucial, because what it's saying is that the percept is not in the brain. That's, of course, the naive reductionist view. The percept is in the brain. It's actually out there. So you see, the question is, you look at the star. Is the star inside my head, as the reductionist says, or is the star really out there? Well, what this is saying, it's saying neither. The star is both, because perception, it's four-dimensional. It's the four-dimensional link between the star out there and the star, the image in my brain. The brain and the star are just two ends of this four-dimensional chain. And so phenomenal space is part of space-time, it's the outlook tree, and the object and the brain are just two ends of a four-dimensional chain. And so, to me, now we're talking about normal perception now, nothing paranormal or mystical, and yet to me, this is such an important way of looking at things. What I think of isn't in my head, it's my experience is actually space-time itself. So you can see what this is. It's actually a sort of mixture of naive realism and representation theory, because in a four-dimensional view, that's what happens. Now, but this is ordinary perception. What about extending this to other sorts of percepts? So if I can, in some sense, describe physical perception in this way, in a way which, in some sense, puts perceptions out there, can I do it to the rest of the physical world? Can I do it to the rest of the perceptual world? And that's the view I want to get across. Is this getting too complicated? Anyway, you can ask me about it later, because it is some of these philosophical ideas, I think, are just as difficult as some of the physical ideas, to be honest. Now let's go through some of our other types of mental experiences. See how this works. What about memory space? You see, the classical view is that the standard view is that memories are stored in your brain, but not in this view. In this view, a memory, if I have a physical event, I close my eyes, I memorize that event. In this case, the memory of a physical event reflects the direct access of consciousness to the space-time which contains the original event. So it's a sort of re-experiencing of the past. And, if you have eidetic imagery, for example, that's just how it seems. But the point is that this four-dimensional structure, so this is my way of looking at memory. It's basically, this is my world line of my brain again, and there is all the nexus of connections, and there is some memory, some event in the past. So the idea is if I had a nice experience, if I met Peter and had a nice dinner with him yesterday, I'm now remembering it, I'm actually linking with that event in space-time. So the idea is the memory is not in the brain, it's actually part of space-time. But you see, if you're going to say perception isn't in the brain, you're going to say memory isn't in the brain. So, and so the idea is that therefore memory is it's a tag, not a trace. No one denies there is an actual something going on in the brain as well, but the point is that the event itself, the memory itself, exists in space-time. What about dream space? Now, we spend a lot of time in our dreams, of course, and it's easy to assume that dreams are just our own personal world. They take part in a space, though. What is undoubtable is if you have... I have very vivid dreams, and dreams are in a space, and so much like physical space, I often can't tell whether I'm awake or asleep. So dreams take part in a space. We tend to think they're our private space, but there's lots of evidence that things like ESP and precognition occurs in dreams. So there is a link between our dream spaces and between our dream space and the physical world. Price, the philosopher Price, said... he proposed that physical events and dream events existed in different space-times. He said, we inhabit two worlds simultaneously, the world of common experience, governed by physical laws, and another space, quite as real, which obeys other laws. Continuous dream life goes on throughout our waking hours, and occasionally we may catch a glimpse of it. And Broad, he wanted to merge dream space and phenomenal space into a single space of more dimensions in which all kinds of sensations exist. So this is the beginning of the idea in the 1950s that you have a space which contains both the physical world and our mental experiences. What about ESP space? Now, how do we interpret telepathy? Well, if I think of a cat... I think there's a cat in my mind, and Kirsten picks up the cat in my mind. Maybe in some sense there really is a cat there, and we are in some sense both seeing this. It's obviously not a physical cat, but maybe maybe there is, telepathy implies there is some communal mental space. In some sense, non-physical percepts can have some of the attributes of externality. So that's the model of telepathy, which is indicated by this little picture here. So these are two mental cats, which in some sense are in a space. And they're in a box, which represents the sort of communal reality. And what about clairvoyance? Well, in clairvoyance, physical objects seem to have internality. I mean, in some sense, in clairvoyance, although you're in your mental world, you seem to have access to the outside physical world. So in that sense, physical objects seem to have aspects of internality. And so maybe we can represent this in this sort of diagram. There is the cat, but there is the mental cat, and even the physical cat has a sort of higher-dimensional aspect. And so in this higher-dimensional box, the higher-dimensional reality structure, I already contain the physical. So this higher-dimensional reality structure contains the physical. Now... That's a model, if you like, of ESP. But what about all the other experiences which are called psychic? And what I want to argue is that all these experiences require some sort of space. Some of you may have gone to the meeting we had last August about the sort of threshold experiences on the border of sleeping and waking. Associated with sleep paralysis. The point is you have sleep paralysis and you hear things and you see things. There's like another level of reality, which isn't physical reality, but it seems just as real. But it takes place this is the book by David Huffert, The Terror That Comes in the Night. He's one of our speakers. Apparitions. Now, there's no doubt that a large number of people see apparitions. They see ghosts. And of course, normally you just say those ghosts are just creations, hallucinations. But it's not as simple as that, because very often those ghosts, you can have, for example, collective apparitions which more than one person will see. So you might have some walking through, you'll see Queen Elizabeth walking along here and more than one person may see her. And of course, there's the traditional ghost story where people at different times see the same image in a haunted room or something. And yet... So it's as though those apparitions really exist in some sense, but they're not physical. I mean, my friend Tony Cornell, he spent his whole life looking for ghosts and looking for physical signatures of ghosts, you know, changes in temperature and photographs and changes in magnetic field. He didn't actually find anything. So it's as though apparitions exist in a space. They seem to have a communal reality because they can convey information and more than one person can see them, but it doesn't seem to be physical space. I'm actually very dubious of photographs of ghosts, for example, like that one there. I suspect it's not really a photograph of a ghost. But I do believe that there are ghosts. Out-of-body experiences. Well, of course, we all know about out-of-body experiences. The key thing about out-of-body experience, you seem to move around in a space. And naively, it seems to be physical space. And yet, if you're having the experience, it's just like being in the room, physical room, and yet it's not quite right, because actually then you'll go through the ceiling and you'll find that the chimney's the wrong color or the wrong shape or something. So it's like it's like a sort of copy of the physical world, but not quite the physical world. On the other hand, that doesn't mean it's imagination too, because sometimes people can have their out-of-body experiences and they can actually be seen by someone else, or they can see something going on in another part of the physical world. So in some sense, it's like physical space, but it's not the same as physical space. Near-death experiences, well, of course, many experts on near-death experiences here, and you know all about those and the tunnel and things. There's a lot of spatial characteristics. The key thing about a near-death experience is that it takes place in a space, but it's not actually physical space, although it may in some sense contain physical space. This also connects with survival, because, of course, presumably, if you believe in survival, I mean survival after death, presumably the soul or whatever exists, or the subtle body exists in some other space. And so the question is, what is that other space? And presumably one wants to relate that survival space to the space experience in a near-death experience, because that naturally leads on to the survival space. And then there's the mystical experiences. Well, of course, there are all sorts of... Paul Marshall's wonderful book about describing the different types of mystical experiences. But again, many of them, what are called the extroverted mystical experiences, all involve a space. So the message is clear. You need a space which is not the same as physical space, but relates to it. And it somehow unifies all these different spaces. I've talked about phenomenal space, that's the normal physical space, perception, normal physical space, memory space, dream space, ESP space, and all these other spaces. I need a space. That is the key message. I need a space for all these different types of mental experience. So I've got here a little table of all these different mental spaces, and I've really gone through them all, but I'll just... So phenomenal space, memory, visualization space, dream space, that's the normal category. Paranormal ones, psi, apparition, threshold, and then you might call the spiritual mental spaces, OBE, NDE, survival, and mystical. And so we need some... How do we get this mental space? How do we get this space? Well, you remember I talked about our view of reality, starting off with a three-dimensional view of reality and then going to this four-dimensional view of reality. I want us to go one more step further and say, is this concept what I call a universal structure? Mental experiences can be accommodated in a higher-dimensional reality structure which reconciles our different experiences of the world. It has a hierarchical structure and incorporates physical space as well as non-physical parts accessed by the mind and the spirit. So the very first picture I gave you sort of had this idea of here are our different perceptions of the world, and this is the cube, this is the four-dimensional space-time which reconciles them. But now let's imagine that the real reality is a higher dimensional, which I'm representing by this hypercube just as a symbol. And these are our mental experiences. So the idea is that this universal structure is a higher-dimensional reality which reconciles all our experiences, including the physical world. But now the question, and I want you to go back way back to the beginning of the talk, which was an embarrassingly long time ago. Okay, 1 hour, 20 minutes ago. So you remember the the Randolph, this picture of the brain bulk picture, that our world is a four-dimensional slice in this high-dimensional space. And that's the picture. That's the picture which I want to get across, that actually we exist in the physical world is just a slice of this higher dimensional reality. And so it looks rather complicated, but I sort of have in my unification of spaces, I actually associate, as I go up these different mental spaces, I'm using higher dimensions. And there's like a hierarchy of these mental experiences, and they involve higher and higher dimensions. And so I've only managed to sort of give a little glimpse of it, but that's the sort of picture I have, that this universal structure is what is going to unify all this mental space. So the four-dimensional structure associated with the physical world is just the one at the top. Now, of course, this is only a theory. Okay, but of course, the point is to try and link this with experience. And is it just imagination? Well, all I can say is this, that there have been, I haven't talked about it, but throughout the last 100 years, there have been lots of people who theorized about the role of higher dimensions, not just in physics, but in more mystical contexts. And I have a whole other talk, which is about, the idea of, I've got a few little pictures. I'll just show you a few pictures just to give you the idea what I mean by dimensionality, one, two, and three dimensions, four-dimensional reality. I'm trying to get across the idea of higher dimensions, which is rather complicated, but we've got a line, a square, a cube, and then this is a hypercube, which is the four-dimensional thing. And for a long time, people were interested in the fourth dimension, and the famous, I'm just going to show one of these pictures, the famous example of this was the book by Abbott on Flatland. Have you read the Abbott book? You know the Abbott book? Abbott said, well, let's imagine that we are creatures confined to a two-dimensional world. And then let's imagine that some creature from the third dimension intervened. Then that creature, or that interaction, would produce all sorts of anomalies. So, for example, your bottle of wine could mysteriously be evacuated because the spirit is sucking it out through the third dimension. Okay. You could, for example, turn around in this extra dimension and your polarity would change. So your heart would go from being on the left to being on the right. Okay. And you could have something which would disappear from this room because it's gone into the extra dimension and then it reappears somewhere else, which we call it an apport. Okay, the sort of spiritualistic science-type phenomena. Which, remember, this was being proposed at the time of spiritualism. And then things which seem to be disconnected might all be connected in the higher dimension. So all of you four, you think you're separate, okay? But actually, with this extra dimension, you're all connected. You're all part of this higher organism. And of course, not just you, but the whole room. Not just the whole room, the whole universe. And so this is a wonderful analogy. It's an analogy because he's talking about two dimensions and asking what would happen if there was a third dimension. But he's showing how adding an extra dimension can allow all sorts of strange phenomena, which of course are precisely analogous to the sort of things we encounter in spirit, in mystical experiences and parapsychological experiences. So anyway, the message I've tried to get across is that that higher dimensions are going to play a crucial role in the linking of matter and mind. And so I always like to quote Paul Brunton, who's a theosophist, we must learn to mentalize space and spatialize mind. And actually, one thing I've not talked about so far at all is time, which I think I will simply do on another occasion. I have another talk about time and how time fits into these extra dimensions, because I've not been very clear, very explicit so far in how time relates to these extra dimensions. But suffice it to say that in this way of looking at things, these extra dimensions, in fact, relate to different levels of time. And that's why a key feature in these experiences is the different levels of time at which you can perceive the universe. But I think what I'm going to do, because I've already run out of time, so I'm going to stop at this point. And can we have the lights on? I'm sorry about that film not showing, because it was really a bit annoying, because it was almost... And so we can just go into questions and things like that. Mm.
Have you ever been taken on a tour of the universe quite so comprehensively? Mm. That was really wonderful. Who's going to ask some questions?
Well, just an idea maybe. In social sciences, not to get too academic, we talk about social constructivism, which means that our reality is socially constructed in each moment. Mm. And I just wonder if this concept could be morphed into what you are working on in a way that mind and time, instead of creating another dimension, would rather represent a mechanic force causing the other dimensions to redefine themselves. If I'm clear.
Yes, I mean, that's an interesting question, which I've never really thought about too much. I mean, in social sciences, though, is one accepting that there is an external reality, or are you saying that it's all a construction? Is one accepting there is just different ways of perceiving a definite reality, or...
It depends which paradigm you take. It obviously depends which paradigm you take. But we would say, in social constructivism, we would say that the reality is not there. It's being redefined all the time through our perception. So I just wonder if this perception, this mind, can be redefining the matter... Instead of creating another dimension.
Well, instead of using another dimension. Well, I mean, first of all, the idea of this, of invoking extra dimensions, is that you are consistently describing how different people describe the world, okay? So the idea is that we all perceive the world in different ways, and at first you might think a simple three-dimensional picture would work, that would fit together all the ways we see the world, but we know it doesn't work, so we went to four dimensions, but even that didn't explain consistently our experiences of out-of-body experiences or mystical states or whatever. So the idea is that always you're trying to reconcile different views of the world. Okay, that's always the aim in looking for this high-dimensional, in looking for this reality structure. You're trying to reconcile different views of the world. And in that sense, I suppose... One is, it's relating to what you're doing in the humanities, you're in social sciences. You're trying to reconcile different perspectives. Now, I suppose the difference is that, of course, I am starting off with the assumption that there is actually an ultimate reality out there. However, I would also say that even though there is a reality out there, there would be many different ways of describing it. Now, for example, I've tried to describe this reality in terms of higher dimensions because I'm a relativist and I think in terms of these axes in different dimensions. So to me, the natural way of trying to describe the world is in terms of this higher dimensional space. Doesn't mean it's the only way of describing it. For example, if you ask me what this universal structure actually is, it's ultimately a sort of information space. It contains information. Our experiences are, if you like, information. Now, of course, there's more to life than information, but nevertheless, there are informational aspects to it. Now, there may be many different ways of describing this reality which don't have to be explicitly in terms of higher dimensions. Quantum theory is a different sort of description of reality from ordinary four-dimensional reality, relativity theory. And so... I'm not saying that these higher dimensions are the only way of looking at it, but I'm saying it's, in some sense, your different ways of representing it can be mapped into each other. So if I say that everything consists of, I mean, you know, I sometimes think, you know, higher dimensions, it's just a mathematical game, you know, you might say, even within physics, people argue about whether these higher dimensions are real or whether they're just a mathematical construct. So your question can really be addressed even to conventional physicists. Are these higher dimensions just a social construct? Is just a mathematical construct? or is it physically real? And that's what physicists argue about. So certainly since physicists argue about it, even in the context of physics, certainly you can argue about it in the context of these broader domain of experiences. So it's a very interesting question which I've not thought through very carefully, but I would say, yes, there may be other ways of describing this reality, but nevertheless, underlying it all is the concept that there is some form of reality there, some what I'm calling this universal structure, which may be described in many ways, but there is this reality which reconciles our different views. And there, I'm not sure if that is compatible with your view, because I think the social science view is that it's in some sense all a creation with no absolute reality. I'm not sure if, yeah. So, but anyway, but thank you, that's a very interesting question. So,
I'm not sure how to put this question, because I think when you said we need another thing on time, I don't think we can understand this without knowing more about time. I mean, higher dimensions, are they cyclical time? I think that everything is time. All matter is some kind of time.
Yes.
And I don't quite understand how one can combine this combination of space, it seems, without time.
Absolutely. And I mean, and in fact, the...
Can you give a sort of simple clue?
Of course. I mean, the third part of my talk was precisely on this problem, because maybe I can just show at least one of my slides as part of this. There's a fundamental problem in time, which is that which is the problem of the flow of time.
Yes, I think we're brainwashed.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, this is the normal picture of space-time, which I told you about, and there's the world line of the brain, if you like. Now, we tend to think of our consciousness as sort of travelling up the world line of our brain, rather like a little bead on a wire. So our experience of time is one in which, if you like, our consciousness moves up the world line of the brain. But the trouble is, and then we've also got this idea that we've got possible futures. So, for example, you can make a decision like whether to stay for the talk or leave early or whatever, and your consciousness interacts. So we've got this idea that there are possible futures.
I don't actually mean that. What I mean is when your consciousness becomes simplified and more unified, there is no time at all.
Sure. I'm getting to that briefly. But now, but the key point, I'm actually using your question as an excuse to go on a little bit about something I didn't say. But the key point about this is that this four-dimensional picture actually does not describe this flow of time at all. It's meaningless. You can't even talk about a flow of time within the four-dimensional picture, because it's simply not part of the description. In other words, you need a sort of extra time to describe it. And the way in which this was done, an actual way of doing this is to introduce a sort of another time, which is a sort of mental time. And so these, in the approach I'm taking, which has got historical precedent in people like Broad and people, that you actually use a second dimension of time to explain the flow of time. And so you have a sort of, if you like, a five-dimensional view of the world in which you explain the experience of time. So these extra dimensions are actually associated with time in some sense. But then you ask the question, well, and this is used to explain things like memory and precognition. But then the crucial question is, how does this explain your individual consciousness? And for that, you need a new component, which is to do with the nature of the specious present. So let me just say this, just summarize this, is that in this particular view, these extra dimensions are wrapped up. There's a hierarchy of extra dimensions which are closed, and they have a sort of a time scale associated with them, a sort of specious present.
And connected,
if you like, it's connected with the scale of the compactification, but it's related to their energy. And the idea is that each of these levels corresponds to a different specious present. Specious present is the sort of time scale of your experience. And so the actual picture, which I'm just presenting very quickly here, is that actually there are different ways of observing the universe, different levels of consciousness, which involve different specious presence. And those different specious presence correspond to this hierarchy of wrapped up dimensions. So that's how time comes into this picture. So I've gone over it very quickly, but I mean, it's a crucial question. So
there's probably only time for one more. I'd like to ask you one question, really just to see if I can draw something out from you. You were saying memory is outside the brain. And you use the wonderful word tag. In other words, the neuronal flow is the tag which indexes the memory, which is outside the brain. Would you like to just go into that in a little more detail?
Yeah. Of course, I think within neuroscience, that the question of how memory is stored in the brain is an answer.
No, it's getting very close to being answered.
I mean, I'm not denying, of course, that anything that happens in the outside world does produce something in the brain. And so I'm not saying that there isn't anything. I mean, just like a photograph. I mean, remember I gave the example of a photograph from a four-dimensional point of view. An event happens, you take a photograph, and then the photograph is looked at. So it's part of a four-dimensional sequence. Now, no one is denying that the photograph contains information. Valid information about the event in the world, but the point is that it's just part of this four-dimensional process. It's not the actual event itself. It's a reflection, a lower-dimensional reflection of the photograph. So then, the analogy of that is that the brain, of course, does contain anything that happens makes some impact on the brain. So that just like anything you photograph has some impact on the print. So I'm not denying, of course, that there are memories contained in the brain, and I take a sort of filter view of the brain, so that I think that the brain is not the creator, the generator of the experience, but merely the process through which you observe the universe. So, of course, I'm not denying that if you are linked to the brain and you're observing the world through the brain, that your memories are impeded and all your mental processes are affected by the brain, so long as you are perceiving the world through the brain. But I would claim that is not inconsistent with saying that the actual the memories or the experiences themselves are outside the brain. In other words, I accept entirely, if I have an out-of-body experience or a near-death experience, that may well have some permanent signature in the brain. But I would say that that does not mean that the brain is generating the experience. It's merely saying that there is this external reality and the brain is, you know, glimpsing that reality, and that external reality is making some form of impact on the brain, but it doesn't mean that the actual outside reality is inside the brain and generated by the brain.
Okay, well, we'll have to end it there, and I think that was a lovely summary conclusion, really. So I'd like you all to thank Bernard very much indeed. What is enormously exciting for me about the theories that Bernard is producing is that at long last, physicists are beginning to tangle with this real problem of consciousness. Where is it? Neuroscience has failed in many ways to define consciousness. And in fact, the more you look into the brain, even at the scale of individual electrodes, you still aren't able to define consciousness properly. It looks as if you're using the wrong tools for it. So we've got to have new models. And I think we're very lucky to have this model which Bernard has produced, multidimensional model, very exciting. And it's nice to see that consciousness now is being included in a proper universal model. So thank you very much indeed, Bernard, and thank you for coming along.